Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 511, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, 25 years later, being recorded on May 22nd of the year 2005. On May 23rd of 1980, I recorded the first of the archive shows, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, with my former co-host, Mark Ortiz. And we're going to jump back for Auld Lang Syne and also for historical perspective, and we're going to continue with the story of American corporate involvement in the rise of Nazism. And in particular, at the distance of 25 years, take a look at some of the prognostications engaged in by James Stewart Martin back in 1950, echoed by Mark Ortiz and yours truly in 1980, and see if what we were looking at in 1980 has not, to a certain extent, taken place or is taking place. Here is Side 2 of Uncle Sam and the Swastika from May 23rd, 1980.
The second area in which Standard Oil provided IG Farben with an absolutely critical element in war production concerned the transfer of iso-octane and tetraethyl lead.
This information and the patents involved in it enabled the Germans to make good quality gas for their road vehicles and, most importantly, for their airplanes. Iso-octane is one of the substances that's used to test gasoline, and it is from iso-octane that we derive the octane numbers that rate the quality of gasoline that you see on the gas pump. Standard taught IG Farben and the Germans about iso-octane and about its good anti-knock properties in engines, and taught them how to make it and use it in testing gasoline. Tetraethyl lead, as many of you are probably aware, is an effective anti-knock additive to gasoline. By putting just a small amount of tetraethyl lead in gasoline, its tendency to knock in an engine is drastically reduced. That enables you to build the engine with a higher compression ratio that makes the engine more efficient. It makes more power from less fuel, and it weighs less and takes up less room doing it. Translating that to an airplane, it means that you need good high-octane gasoline to build a competitively fast, high-flying, long-range airplane. In other words, without this technology, Germany could never have fielded a competitive air force in World War II.
Tetraethyl lead was developed in the United States by the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation. That was jointly owned by both Standard Oil and General Motors, 50% ownership by each firm. IG Farben requested the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation to provide them with the patent technology and the technical know-how to enable them to manufacture their own tetraethyl lead. The War Department got wind of the negotiations between Ethyl Gasoline and IG and wrote a letter to Mr. Webb, the General Motors official who was president of the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation, and pointed out that providing Germany with tetraethyl technology would be giving them an absolutely essential war-making item, an absolutely a vital war commodity, and that basically they should not do so under any circumstances, because obviously this would have grave implications for the United States and its allies, or potential allies. So Mr. Webb then wrote the Defense Department, said, don't worry, we won't do that, and then turned right around and provided IG with tetraethyl lead. The granting of the tetraethyl license to IG, and this is important, was the first time that such a license was granted to any competitor outside of the United States. And it's also interesting to note that IG was not able to manufacture enough tetraethyl lead from their plants in order to meet Hitler's timetable for the invasion of Poland. So instead, the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation loaned them 500 tons of tetraethyl lead so that they could proceed with the invasion of Poland. Also sold them $20 million worth of aviation gasoline
containing tetraethyl lead.
And so as a result, Hitler's timetable was not disrupted. Interestingly enough, the collateral for this loan, which was forfeited by IG, was arranged through Brown Brothers Harriman and Company, a firm involving the Harriman brothers, W. Averill Harriman, but more importantly, his younger brother, E. Roland Harriman. And the iso-octane technology was also the first, the providing of iso-octane by standard 2IG was the first time that an iso-octane license had been granted outside of the United States as well.
One point I'd like to interject, again relating this to the present, this ethyl gasoline corporation that sold this tetraethyl lead was a joint venture half owned by General Motors, half owned by Standard Oil. Again, with this plus the company that arranged the financing, we see the activities of an interlocking network of corporate power and corporation owner power that exists to this day and still functions throughout the world.
The third area in which Standard Oil provided Nazi Germany through IG Farben with an essential war component concerned the transfer of the technology for making butyl rubber.
Now, butyl rubber is a common ingredient in tires, but until the late 30s it wasn't known. Butyl rubber, apart from the fact that you don't have to have access to rubber trees in order to obtain it, is also a non-porous rubber. Most rubber has little pores in it, and if you make an inner tube or a rubber raft out of normal rubber, natural rubber, or most kinds of synthetic rubber, the air will leak out after a while, even if there are no ruptures or holes in the part that you made. However, butyl rubber is exceptionally good for sealing, so it's a common choice for inner tubes, tires, life rafts, fuel bladders, but lots of things, anything that has to contain air. There was also another kind of rubber involved in this, which was Buna rubber.
B-U-N-A, by the way.
Which is still available in the United States. It's Buna is actually a trademark. The name of that kind of rubber is nitrile rubber. Neoprene, which you may have on the soles of your shoes, is related to that. Also, the main important property of Buna rubber is its resistance to petroleum and petroleum-related chemicals. So it's very important for fuel bladders in airplanes, gaskets, seals, hoses, anything that has to resist anything that's made out of oil. Now, what happened with the Buna process is the Germans developed it, and while the Germans got access to the American butyl process, the Americans did not get access to the German Buna process.
Basically, how this worked out, in 1930, Standard and IG arrived at the so-called JASCO agreement, J-A-S-C-O, referring to the Joint American Study Corporation. JASCO was owned 50% by IG, 50% by Standard Oil. What this did was it was basically a cartel agreement, which assured that Standard would not interfere with IG's exclusive province, which was chemicals, and that IG in turn would not interfere with Standard Oil's oil business. Now, under the terms of the JASCO agreement in 1938, Standard Oil provided the Nazis through IG Farben with all of the butyl patents and technical know-how. They requested the Buna patents and know-how in return. And finally, after the outbreak of war in Europe, they received the Buna patents, but they never received the Buna technical know-how, without which the patents were really not that effective, so that it was a clear case of where Standard restricted the development of an essential component of modern warfare in this country and provided the Nazis with an equally essential element under the terms of that same agreement. I think in all of the reading that I've done about the industrial cooperation between this country and Hitler's Third Reich, I think one of the most astounding things I came across was a method whereby American insurance companies cooperated with the Germans in such a way as to provide them with really astounding amounts of intelligence concerning not only U.S. plants, but also U.S. shipping. Remember that the Battle of the North Atlantic was absolutely critical to the eventual success of the Allies. And I'd like to point out before I read this that, of course, this coming weekend is going to be Memorial Day, at which time America pauses to remember its dead from the foreign wars. Bear in mind that during the Battle of the North Atlantic, the losses among Allied merchant seamen were roughly 1 in 3. A third of all seamen sailing that route lost their lives. Keep that in mind as you listen to the following. As James Stewart Martin, in All Honorable Men, as I mentioned, the chief of the Economic Warfare Section of the Department of Justice, as he was preparing to go to Germany in 1945, worked behind the advancing Allied armies in order to begin investigating German war production, he began to reminisce. Martin writes, "On a bleak night in February 1945, I found myself standing with my small party of investigators in the mist at the Washington airport waiting to take off. As I stood in the gloom, observing all the security measures that shrouded our routine departure, the blackout of the field and the plane, the silence, the sudden orders, I remembered our discovery earlier in the war of how easily the secrecy, unquote, of ship sailings had been penetrated by the Germans. In 1940, 41, and 42, ships leaving American seaports had had the same security measures to protect their departure. Yet many of their broken hulls and water-soaked cargoes had washed up onto the beaches of New Jersey, Virginia, and the Carolinas, where German submarines had spotted them within sight of shore. In case after case, every man on board had been marked before the captain opened his orders, though they may not have known it. The cargoes they carried were reinsured with Munich. The routine system of placing insurance had put precise information on their sailing date and destination in the hands of the Germans before the ship left port. In the summer of 1941, before there was any economic warfare section, several trust busters discovered that while the American public was looking more and more askance at German business connections, insurance companies doing an international business seemed to have no such doubts about their foreign commitments. Insurers of large risks, such as ships, cargoes, and industrial plants, customarily spread the risk among other companies willing to take fractional shares. The big insurance and reinsurance companies in the United States which handle the largest risks have such treaties on an international basis through arrangements with the Lloyd's Group in England or with the Zurich Group in Switzerland. It had long been the custom of the American companies to place the reinsurance on ships and cargoes with the Zurich Group by cabling information to them so that they could accept responsibility for a share of the American insurer's risk. The information cabled would include the name of the ship, the sailing date, the cargo carried, the destination, and the value of the insured property. One detail that should have raised someone's eyebrow but did not until the government stepped in was the fact that the Zurich Group in turn had a reinsurance treaty with the Munich Reinsurance Pool in Germany. The result was that during 1940 and early 1941, by the time a ship had cleared New York or Baltimore Harbor headed for a European port, the German intelligence service already had the sailing data in hand. When men from the Department of Justice called a conference of insurance representatives, the companies agreed to stop sending such information by cable. But even then, no one realized what an efficient pipeline the Germans had set up. It appeared later that everyone concerned, both government officials and insurance men, assumed that sending the information by mail to Switzerland would be perfectly all right. Nothing was said about stopping completely the transmission of reinsurance information. In the spring of 1942, after we had started to set up the economic warfare section, we found that reinsurance information sheets, or bordereau, B-O-R-D-E-R-A-U-X, were still going to Switzerland by mail. We also discovered that the reinsurance business, far from being confined to ships and cargoes, also covered industrial plants, and more especially those very large new plants being built for war production, the ones with security guards at the gates to see that no unauthorized eyes got inside. In the case of industrial plants, we found that the reinsurance bordereau did not account for the full extent of the leakage. The usual reinsurance treaty on such risks provides that the reinsurance group has the right to demand copies of a full report by the insurance inspector. This report includes blueprints of the installation, description of the fire hazards and risks, and inventory of the contents of the buildings room by room. We found that before 1938, the Zurich Group had asked for the full insurance inspector's report in only 5 or 6% of the cases. After 1938, the full report was requested with increasing frequency until the percentage was closer to 90. It had seemed obvious to us that the government ought to stop this transmission of shipping and industrial information through Switzerland to the Reich. Unlike the United States, the German government as early as 1936 had closed off such information about Germany. As soon as the Germans occupied France, Belgium, and Holland in 1940, they put a stop to all such transmissions from those countries. We proposed to have the Attorney General send a letter to each company warning that transmission of marine and industrial plant information of this type came within the scope of the Espionage Act. Issuance of such a letter in the name of the Attorney General, however, required approval by the Solicitor General, Charles Fahey. Mr. Fahey would not take this responsibility without consulting the other interested departments of the government. At first, no one could believe that Americans were handing the German intelligence service information on a silver platter. At one of Mr. Fahey's interdepartmental meetings, Joseph Borken, then of the Antitrust Division, slapped down on the table a stack of insurance inspectors' reports on various prominent buildings. He had purchased these from sources open to anyone in the insurance business without any special security clearance. For 55 cents, he had the plans of the White House showing the location of the fire extinguishers and other protective apparatus. For 75 cents, he had the plans of a large new magnesium plant. One of the blueprints had an arrow pointing at a valve with the legend, "Under no circumstances must this valve be closed while the plant is in operation, as an explosion would result."
Well, in view of the Memorial Day weekend, I think it also bears saying that it's a tribute to the dedication and ability of American fighting men that we were able to win the war at all.
Before we wind up here, I'd like to mention one more book in addition to Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler and Who Financed Hitler, which is commonly available. One of James Stewart Martin's cohorts, one of his co-workers in the economic warfare section of the Department of Justice, was a man named Joseph Borkin, B-O-R-K-I-N. He wrote a superb book entitled The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. Farben, by the way, is F-A-R-B-E-N. This was published by Pocket Books in 1979. So that's another book that you can consult in order to try and learn a little more about the events we've been talking about. And one of the reasons why people as a whole had way in which it was buried was by appointing representatives of the very same interests which had financed Hitler and basically built up his war industry in the first place to the Allied bodies in charge with the responsibility of investigating the German war economy. James Stewart Martin writes about the frustrations which his group met in attempting to evaluate German war-making industry, and the causes of those frustrations, he writes. "We settled down out of the sky over England into a fog-covered beehive called Bushy Park, headquarters for the future military government of Germany, then known as the U.S. Group Control Council. Brigadier General Cornelius W. Wickersham was in command, and it was on our way to report to him that we got our first forewarning of opposition to come. Together with Norman Bursler and Alexander Sachs, I was walking through the hall of a temporary wooden office building when Alex pointed to the name of Colonel Graham K. Howard over the office door of the director of the Economics Division. Howard was the author of a book written in 1940 before the United States entered the war called America and a New World Order, an apologia for the Nazi economic system that might just as well have been titled You Can Do Business with Hitler. Now it looked as though we were to be working with him and others like him in an effort to reconstitute Germany on a new pattern. Colonel Howard was only the first of many who turned up, riding into Germany with a future military government, helping to deflect the policy back into the old grooves. Colonel Howard, it is true, was straightaway relieved of his duties before we left Bushy Park for the continent. In fact, just after General Wickersham received a copy of his book from the Intelligence Division. But trick pennies are the same on both sides. The position of economic director was filled by the assignment from Washington of Brigadier General William H. Draper, Jr., on military leave from his position as Secretary Treasurer of Dillon Reed & Company. This investment banking firm after World War I had taken the lead in floating the German bonds, which put German industry in a position to fight another war. The men with whom Colonel Howard had already staffed the Economics Division clearly wanted the occupation of Germany to be carried out along quite different lines from those decided upon by the government departments at Washington. Coordination between the plans of the Economics Division and the policies laid down by Washington became more and more difficult. The constant carping and the mounting criticism of the official policies became so open that General Wickersham finally found it necessary to issue a formal order to all officers under his command, requiring them to stop their criticism and to support and advocate the policies laid down in the Joint Chiefs of Staff Directive. Our special team was assigned to work in the Finance Division with Captain Norbert A. Bogdan, a charming fellow who had been a vice president of the J. Henry Schroeder Banking Corporation, a firm in whose files the Nazi banking affiliations were still warm when the United States went to war. Anthony C. Sutton, in the book we told you about earlier, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, further discusses the makeup of the U.S. Group Control Council, developing further upon what James Stewart Martin said. He quotes from a memo written by Treasury Secretary Morgenthau to President Truman on May 29, 1945. He writes, "Lewis Douglas, whom General Clay describes as my personal advisor on economical, financial, and governmental matters. Douglas resigned as director of the budget in 1934, and for the following 8 years, he attacked the government's fiscal policies. Since 1940, Douglas has been president of the Mutual Life Insurance Company, and since December 1944, he has been a director of the General Motors Corporation. Edward X. Zdunke, is to supervise the engineering section. Prior to the war, Mr. Zdunke was head of General Motors at Antwerp. Philip Getke is to be in charge of mining operations. Getke was formerly connected with Anaconda Copper and was manager of its smelters and mines in Upper Silesia before the war. Philip P. Clover is to be in charge of handling oil matters. He was formerly a representative of the Saucony Vacuum Oil Company in Germany. Peter Hoagland is to deal with industrial production problems, and Hoagland is on leave from General Motors and is said to be an expert on German production. The memo concludes with some information which further develops the background of Graham K. Howard, author of America and a New World Order. Secretary Morgenthau writes, "One of the men who helped General Draper in the selection of personnel for the Economics Division was Colonel Graham Howard, a vice president of General Motors, who was in charge of their overseas business and who was a leading representative of General Motors in Germany prior to the war. Howard is the author of a book in which he praises totalitarian practices, justifies German aggression and the Munich policy of appeasement, and blames Roosevelt for precipitating the war." Well, as you might well imagine, the presence of these interests on the U.S. Group Control Council enabled the American financial and industrial concerns that had worked with Nazi Germany to hide their involvement. Interestingly enough, it also guaranteed that their German associates would be returned to important positions in the post-war reconstruction of Germany, as they were. Because, see, if the victors had dealt too harshly with the vanquished, their own role in the creation of the conflict would have been revealed, and so they covered it up. Before we conclude, in evaluating the forces that had led to the defeat of his group's efforts to bring about German reform, James Stuart Martin feared two things. First, he was afraid that the return to power of Hitler's industrialists would lead to a resurgence of Nazism in Germany. And more importantly, Martin noted that the same pattern of economic concentration that led to the ascendance of Hitler in Germany was already evident in the United States in 1950, and he expressed his fear that this concentration of power might lead to the rise of Nazism in this country. Martin concludes All Honorable Men by discussing the economics of fascism and his fears for both Germany and the U.S.
Dave and I are going to take turns reading you James Martin's conclusion in All Honorable Men. First, though, we'd like to remind you that we're reading a book written in 1950, and some of Martin's references to German Reconstruction date this text. However, we both feel that Martin's message about the dangers inherent in economic concentration is still as valid as ever.
Proceeding with the conclusion of All Honorable Men, James Stuart Martin writes, "After 2.5 years, I came back from Germany quite well aware that I had been wrestling with a buzzsaw. We had not been stopped in Germany by German business. We had been stopped in Germany by American business. The forces that had stopped us had operated from the United States, but had not operated in the open. We were not stopped by a law of Congress, by an executive order of the President, or even by a change of policy approved by the President or any member of his cabinet. In short, whatever it was that had stopped us was not the government, but it clearly had command of channels through which the government normally operates. The relative powerlessness of governments in the face of growing economic power is, of course, not new. Between the two world wars, the outstanding development in world economics was the division of territories and markets, a private agreement among the largest corporations of Britain, Germany, and the United States, with minor participations by their counterparts in France, Italy, and Japan. National governments stood on the sidelines while bigger operators arranged the world's affairs.
We have the same difficulty today. What we need is to be able to have a government that controls economic power instead of becoming its tool. Since power is a public trust, including economic power, the first job of a government is to see that the power is used in the public interest and not against it. By chartering a private corporation, a government delegates to the corporate body some of its own power to regulate commerce. Strictly speaking, this is an abdication by the government. It is time to view the results of this abdication by constitutional governments in favor of private governments. The occupation of Germany has already provided a good laboratory in which we could study the activities of self-centered corporations and the activities of a German national government in which these corporate combines had a dominant influence.
The eco-political masters of Germany boosted Hitler and his program into the driver's seat at a time when the tide in the political fight between the Nazis and the supporters of the Weimar Republic was swinging against the Nazis. All of the men who mattered in banking and industrial circles could quickly agree on one program and throw their financial weight behind it. Their support won the election for the Nazis. We must assume that the same thing is not yet true in the United States. We do have economic power so concentrated that it would lie in the power of a group of not more than 100 men, if they could agree among themselves, to throw the same kind of combined economic weight behind a single program. They have not agreed yet. There are still enough divisions within the Republican Party and enough minor differences between Republicans and Democrats to indicate that on some fundamental economic questions, there are different points of view, each one championed by a different faction inside the financial and industrial community itself. If the United States should run into serious economic difficulties, however, most of the conditions for a reenactment of the German drama would already exist on the American stage. The slight differences within the camp of the fraternity then may be the only real barrier to the kind of integration of the financial and industrial community behind a single repressive program like that which the financiers and industrialists of Germany executed through Hitler. Are we safe in assuming that it would take a grave economic crisis to precipitate the dangers inherent in economic concentration? The basic integration of the financial and industrial groups in the United States is evident when we look at the increase of concentration in the past few years.
Our job now, then, is to prepare for a future crisis before it happens. This means that in Germany we must have a double objective. The occupation of Germany must be put back on the track. But more than that, we have to reassert public goals in the United States, which will prevent the already apparent concentration of economic power in our own country from reaching the end it did in Germany. We cannot hope to deal with the concentration of economic power in Germany until we are able to deal with the concentration of economic power in the United States. This brings the German problem home with an urgency that has been missing in most post-war discussions about Germany. The need to treat Germany as an American problem was not felt in this country after World War I. Despite warnings from men whose experience with the German occupation had convinced them that we were entering a period of armed truce and not peace, business arrangements went ahead unchecked to rebuild a Germany that could not be expected to be anything but a steamroller. Now, with all that experience and warning behind us, and in spite of strong popular support for the reform of Germany, we have had to watch the same errors being repeated as if nothing else were possible. The moral of this is not that Germany is an inevitable menace, but that there are forces in our own country which can make Germany a menace. And more importantly, those forces could create a menace of their own here at home. Not through a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but as a calm judgment of business necessity. The men who might do this are not Nazis, but businessmen. Not criminals, but honorable men.
Well, that is what Mark Ortiz and yours truly had to say on May 23rd of 1980. How does that look at the distance of 25 years, This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 511, Uncle Sam and the Swastika 25 Years Later, being recorded on May 22nd of the year 2005. For my former co-host Mark Ortiz, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.